Good morning. This is Dallas Townsend with a CBS World News Roundup. First, it was Edward Kennedy, then John Anderson, then Ronald Reagan. This morning, the National Urban League Convention in New York heard from President Carter. The president said, quote, I am here today to renew my permanent pledge that I will never relent in our joint pursuit of equal rights, equal opportunity, and equal dignity for every American. Mr. Carter said he has appointed more members of minority groups to federal judgeships than all other presidents, and he declared he will soon introduce an economic recovery program in which literally millions of jobs will be created. Randy Daniels notes the chief reason for this morning's address by Mr. Carter.
The president is trying to shore up his black support, and the Urban League Convention is a good place to start. 2 years ago, Mr. Carter had to defend his policies in the face of sharp criticism from black leaders, especially Urban League President Vernon Jordan. The charge then was that the president had forgotten the overwhelming support blacks had given him. Although Jordan is now recuperating from wounds suffered in a shooting last May in Fort Wayne, Indiana, his aides have not stifled their criticism of the Carter administration. The mood this week among Urban League delegates has been one of political skepticism. The White House is concerned that skepticism may shift to indifference and have a negative impact on black voter turnout this fall, hurting the president's chances for re-election. Randy Daniels, CBS News, New York.
Ronald Reagan addressed the Urban League yesterday morning, and that was the start of a long day in which the Republican presidential nominee campaigned for black support with mixed results. Reported from Chicago by Derek Blakely.
Reagan's quest for the black vote began in New York before the National Urban League, where, he said, he didn't expect an enthusiastic reception and where, for sure, he didn't receive one. Doubtful delegates heard Reagan ask blacks to look beyond his conservative label and to closely examine his economic plans, plans which call for helping blacks by helping business provide more jobs. But the atmosphere turned from lukewarm to hostile when Reagan visited the devastated South Bronx ghetto. There, crowds shouted down the former governor, telling him to go home. Instead, he went to Chicago for a meeting with black publisher John Johnson, a courtesy call that could produce no tangible results since Johnson's magazines do not endorse political candidates. But the Reverend Jesse Jackson does. And after an hour-long meeting between Jackson and Reagan, both agreed a dialogue had been opened, but Jackson said it was far too soon to support anyone. So Reagan returned to California, vowing to continue his search for black votes and acknowledging that the search will be long, hard, and perhaps only marginally fruitful. Derek Blakely, CBS News, Chicago.
Reagan describes that session in Chicago as exploratory and says he'll meet again with Jackson soon. The Senate committee investigating the Billy Carter case holds its last meeting today before the Democratic National Convention, which opens next Monday in New York. More details about that case are coming to light, reported now by Robert Shackney.
A U.S. intelligence agency informed Attorney General Benjamin Civiletti back last April that there was damaging evidence of a Libyan payment to Billy Carter. And according to Justice Department officials, the Attorney General then alerted his criminal division investigators to keep their Billy Carter case open. The officials say that Civiletti did not pass the substance of the intelligence information on to his investigators, apparently because the source was so sensitive that the information could not be used in a court proceeding. But the officials say Civiletti did tell Criminal Division Chief Philip Hyman to keep the Billy Carter investigation going and to develop a case independently of intelligence sources. It then took the investigating team another month to uncover evidence from bank records of the payments to Billy Carter. Civiletti, in Hawaii for a bar association meeting, was not available for comment, but it's expected he'll issue some kind of statement later today. The White House confirms that the intelligence information about the Libyan payment was available in April, but insists that no one in the White House was informed at the time. Robert Shackney, CBS News, Washington.
Campaign aides of President Carter and Senator Kennedy have agreed on arrangements for some of the main items on the agenda of the convention that opens in New York next Monday. Debate on the controversial rule that would bind delegates to vote for the presidential nominee in accordance with their commitments will take place Monday evening in prime time. The Carter forces favor that rule. The Kennedy people are against it. If the Carter forces win the debate, the president is assured of a first ballot victory. Debate on major disputed planks of the platform will be held Tuesday night, also in prime time. 171 Iranian men and 20 Iranian women, all arrested during a disorderly demonstration in Washington July 27th, were reunited last night in New York City after complying with government regulations and identifying themselves. The two groups had been held at separate federal prisons. Stephanie Sheldon reports.
Union women, many barefoot, march slowly out of the Metropolitan Correctional Center in New York City, chanting their slogans for the cameras and microphones. Marched into waiting cars, which took them to a mosque in Queens and a reunion with the men released earlier from the federal prison in Otisville. At a news conference, lawyer Mark Lane charged the Iranians were beaten, tortured, and harassed by police in Washington, and then, as he put it, kidnapped by federal immigration authorities to New York jails.
We were not allowed to talk to our clients. They were denied every fundamental right which is supposed to belong to everyone who lives in this country.
A number of the Iranian men showed reporters scratches and bruises they claimed were the result of beatings. One said his nose was broken. A woman who talked of mistreatment said she had been kept in hand and leg irons.
They told me that you should walk with your things, and I didn't walk. I couldn't walk. They dragged me to the building, and they hit us.
The Iranians refused to draw any parallels between their situation and that of the American hostages held more than 9 months in Iran. Two different matters, they said over and over. Outside the mosque, about 50 local teenagers holding an American flag chanted USA and shouted epithets at the Iranians. They were kept away by a squadron of police who will remain until the bulk of the Iranian students are bused back to Washington and other cities later today. Stephanie Shelton, CBS News, New York.
Government officials have denied the allegations of mistreatment. Relative calm has returned to Fort Indiantown Gap, Pennsylvania, where several hundred Cuban refugees went on a rampage yesterday. Barry Peterson has details.
Last night brought an uneasy quiet to the refugee camp, racked by days of riots. Camp officials blamed it on frustration and growing helplessness. These refugees have waited for months, hoping for sponsors and a chance to begin the life they dreamed of when they fled their homeland. The rioting was touched off by a weapons search. Army and National Guard troops donned riot gear. Soldiers from Fort Bragg are now on the way as reinforcements. Area residents are frustrated, too, complaining bitterly about vandalism since the Cubans arrived. And Congressman Alan Ertl worries now about how some residents will react to the riots.
From the information I received, they are alarmed, scared, and frankly, many of them are arming themselves, and that's a major concern.
Officials emphasize that most of the 5,000 refugees did not join the violence and that riot leaders may well end up in federal prison. Barry Peterson, CBS News, Fort Indiantown Gap, Pennsylvania.
It was the first such violence at Indiantown Gap. Disturbances among Cuban refugees broke out earlier in the summer at camps in Florida and Arkansas. Day before yesterday, a white farmer, 68-year-old Gerald Adams, was shot and killed in Zimbabwe. Police have now confirmed that a cabinet minister, Edgar Takeri, is being questioned in connection with the case. The story from Ian Mills.
A police spokesman said Adams died when a group of armed men opened fire on his farmhouse, adding that the investigations included questioning Takeri, who is manpower minister in Prime Minister Robert Mugabe's socialist government. The spokesman said a number of weapons had also been seized at Takeri's suburban home in Salisbury. Takeri has been the central figure in the drama, which began late Monday with a police siege on a block of flats in downtown Salisbury. The stakeout started after police found two cars that had been seen at the murder farm parked outside the flat, one of them belonging to Takeri. Official sources said Takeri and his bodyguards were in the building and threatened a shootout with police, who decided to wait until they came out in the morning. The sources said Takeri has agreed to report back to the police today, but so far there's been no official word on any arrests being made. Ian Mills for CBS News, Salisbury.
Hurricane Allen swept past the north coast of Jamaica this morning with highest winds of 135 miles an hour. The storm is now headed west-northwest toward the Cayman Islands. All told, 25 deaths are blamed on Hurricane Allen. The price of gold is virtually unchanged in Europe today. It was fixed in London this morning at $628.50 an ounce. The dollar is on the downside again this morning on the major European exchanges.